Hi, everybody. Welcome to the third episode of the Forensic Anthropology Companion Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kennyhers, and today I'm joined by Dr. Diana Messer.
Hi, I'm Dr. Diana Messer, and I'm an assistant professor of anthropology at Western Carolina University. My primary research interest is skeletal trauma, specifically healing fractures in children and examining what variables affect time of healing. Prior to beginning at Western, I worked at the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency in Hawaii. And before that, I worked as a postdoctoral faculty member at Mercyhurst University, where I also completed my master's degree way back in 2013. And it was there that I developed my interest in skeletal trauma by working with Dr. Steve Sims, who has a very hands-on, learn-as-you-go teaching style and was always happy to have students look over his shoulder as he worked. And he has this incredible deep understanding of skeletal trauma.
And that's actually where Dr. Messer and I's experience overlaps, is that we both went to Mercyhurst for our master's and we both worked with Steve Sims in learning trauma. And as she said, he has a very hands-on approach. And one of the things that Steve would always tell his students is bone acts like bone. And I think this sentiment comes up throughout this article in particular. And because of that, we would like to dedicate this episode of the Forensic Anthropology Companion Podcast to Dr. Steve Sims, who I hope is listening and is doing well.
I feel really fortunate that I was able to study with him, and that led to my interest in this particular article, Forensic Fractography of Bone, A New Approach to Skeletal Trauma Analysis by Angie Christensen et al. Interpreting skeletal trauma can be critical for a pathologist to determine cause and manner of death from a forensic anthropologist's analysis. And this is most often what forensic anthropologists are called in to testify about, but also an area of forensic anthropology that has been largely subjective and experience-based, particularly for blunt force trauma. Dr. Steve Sims has stated that one of the greatest problems in skeletal trauma analysis is inferring too much from too little. So developing better methods and methodological vocabularies to conduct skeletal trauma analyses is crucial as our field moves forward. And I think that's where Dr. Christensen's article comes in. Here's our chat with Dr. Christensen about her article. What drew me to this article was my background and training at Mercyhurst University with Dr. Steve Sims. As you mentioned in the article, his trauma teaching focused on understanding how bone fails, looking for features on the fracture surface, both macroscopically and microscopically, that indicate tensile and compressive forces, as opposed to a more typological approach. But what we didn't have was a lot of literature or studies that really explained those features that we were looking at. And it wasn't until I started practicing anthropology outside of Mercyhurst that I began to realize that not everyone was trained to look at those features, and also that a standard terminology didn't exist to describe them. And that's where your article comes in and provides a methodological vocabulary to look at blunt force fractures. So can you give us the basic idea of your paper?
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about this. So fractography, as many forensic anthropologists may not even know, is looking at cracks and fractures to understand why a material failed or why a structure failed. And you mentioned that there's not a lot of terminology out there, and there isn't in forensic anthropology. But the thing is, fractography as a science has been around for a really long time. And a lot of other scientists use fractography in the study of failure of other materials. So one of the reasons I became interested in this topic for bone is I work in my laboratory with a number of other forensic fractographers. They don't look at bone, they look at failure in materials like glass, ceramics, metals, plastics. And as I started to better understand what it was they were doing when they were doing fractography, I thought, why wouldn't this work for bone, or could this work for bone? And when I mentioned this to one of the fractographers, he basically said, "You mean you guys aren't doing this already?" I said, No. So there is actually a well-developed science out there for the study of failure of particularly brittle materials, which includes bone, but we just didn't really know it existed. And part of the idea here is to sort of bridge that gap and show that these principles that have been around and being applied in other materials for quite some time are also applicable to bone. So this is, at its essence, an engineering approach. So this is looking, as you mentioned, not at typology, not at classifying fractures by their shape. It is trying to understand how and why the bone cracked the way it did, and essentially why and how the bone failed.
Can you walk us through a little bit of how you came up with the research design that you did and kind of what questions you had and how you decided to address them?
So the design was largely exploratory to begin with. So looking at fractured bone surfaces and saying, okay, do these things that we see in broken glass and broken ceramics, do we see these same features in bone? Or are they different in some ways? Are they fundamentally different? Are they just subtly different? Because bone is a brittle material, but it also has that flexible component. So it's not strictly a material, brittle material like a glass or ceramic. It does have that little bit of ductility. So a lot of this was just kind of exploratory to begin with. Do we see these features? If so, which features do we actually see? What do these things look like in bone? So these things like hackle and wake that are already well documented in these other materials, what do these look like on a bone surface? And then what are they telling us about the way the bone cracked or the way the bone failed? So we didn't really go into this with much of a hypothesis other than that we expected that many of these would be found in bone, and it was just a matter of recognizing what these features would look like when we saw them on a broken bone.
In this article, you also looked at the fracture surface using CT scans. Do you think that there might be any potential to use other imaging modalities to look at this and use fractography?
So the CT scanner that we use to look at these fracture surface features is not your everyday CT scanner and not a medical CT scanner. This is a high resolution micro CT scanner. So it's capturing significantly more surface detail than you would with a regular CT scanner. And one of the reasons for looking at these in CT in this case was just to see if it clarified anything. Again, largely exploratory. Does it help elucidate some of these features? Can we see them better? Is it worse? Is this a technique that we would want to use? As another part of this study was looking at what are the best ways to examine these fracture surface features. That's these features. Can we see them better? Is it worse? Is this a technique that we would want to use? As another part of this study was looking at what are the best ways to examine these fracture surface features. That's why we tested oblique lighting, the application of something like fingerprint powder or some sort of contrast media that helps enhance the features. So we just wondered whether CT might be beneficial. I've actually followed up this study with a couple of other research projects or more sort of exploratory studies, looking at whether you can see some of these features on medical CT scanners, which do have significantly lower resolution. And it turns out you can see at least some of the larger, more macroscopic features, meaning that fractography may be applicable beyond dry bone context. We may be able to use this in a medical examiner setting or other, you know, forensic pathology setting other than looking at dry bone. And we may not need to macerate the material in order to look at these fracture surface features.
What directions have you taken this research since its publication? And from there, where are you looking to expand?
I have been involved in a couple of other follow-up research studies, papers on this topic. One working with Dr. Love, which was also published in Forensic Anthropology, where we looked at some of the cases that she had already examined in a medical examiner context, she and the DC medical examiner. And we were able to then look at the fractography and the fracture surface features and compare that to the findings from the traditional forensic anthropological analysis, but also from the autopsy findings, so soft tissue findings, radiologic findings, and found that everything correlated very well. And then I've also worked on two follow-up papers involving medical CTs and found that we can see some of these features on CT scanners. Another direction I'm looking at is a lot of these previous studies have focused on blunt trauma, so that the 2018 paper in Forensic Anthropology was using samples that were broken in four-point bending under controlled experimental conditions. And obviously, that's not how most forensic fractures occur. So that was why the autopsy sample comparison with Dr. Love was very useful. But also, we need to explore other types of trauma mechanisms. So do we see these same features in sharp force trauma? Do we see them in high velocity projectile traumas? And what do those fracture features tell us about that trauma event? Working with one of my students, we actually did find that some of these features are identifiable from high velocity projectile traumas in a Civil War sample. So that is, I think, one potentially interesting avenue. I think one important highlight or something that I would like to point out is that this paper, I think, is really low-hanging fruit. I mean, we picked the biggest bone in the body, fractures that were experimental. I really think this is just the beginning. I think there are really so many different directions that you can take this. And a student out at Michigan State, Mari Issa, is working on some really cool stuff with fractography, where she is looking at high-speed video of fractures created experimentally and then looking at the fractography, looking at the fracture surface features and finding that those fracture surface features correspond very well to the ground truth seen in the high-speed video. So I think that's a very cool high-tech development, a little different avenue for this research. But I really think there's so many different directions that this can go.
Yeah, may I interject just one point? The strength that I see about this is a foundational framework of how we can use this and how we should use this to study something that has escaped us for a long time. There's been so many experimental designs with a rigid surface versus a more flexible surface and these experimental conditions that don't really matter. And they're being viewed under the lens of how we're taught to evaluate trauma, which using this framework, we can directly test those as hypotheses, right? Are the things that we think we know, given how we've been taught to think about trauma as anthropologists, does that hold up under a framework that we can measure? And I think that's the thing that's been lacking in trauma analysis. And this, to me, offers the scaffolding of like, this is a path forward. We don't have to rethink the wheel. We don't have to believe the things that we say or we observe are the things that are true. Other people thought about this. So to me, the value of this is that it's a framework for the future, but also that we should be looking more broadly than our own views to incorporate research ideas. That we don't have to think about the best way to do things because other people that are probably smarter in a mathematical sense already did it. But what we can do is seek how to incorporate that into our own practice to get better, to understand and answer bigger questions, to be more certain in the things that we do say. To me, that's the tenet of science. So this is the foundational step. That's what I love about this article. And that's what I love about showing all of these different features, defining them, showing them how they might be viewed in bone versus other ways. But we actually have a name for it and we have a reason why it has that name. So that's just my two cents on what I think is the most important about this article, which means literally nothing.
Oh, that definitely means something. And one thing that I also want readers to get from this paper, this is an engineering approach. I get that might scare some people off. This is basically taking engineering and fracture mechanics principles and applying them to bone. But I don't think you need to be an engineer to be able to do this. I think for the things that we're looking at in forensic anthropological context, that with a little bit of background knowledge, a few basic skills and some practice and a couple of tools that you probably already have in your laboratory, that people can do this. So also when people are reading this article, they need to sort of ignore Joe Hefner's statistical wizardry and all that stuff that goes on in there and sort of see through that and see that this is a very accessible approach, I think, for most any practitioner.
Along those lines, in the study, you found that experience was a factor in identifying the fractographic features. So are there any plans to have workshops or self-guided training, as was mentioned, so that people can gain more familiarity and comfortability with using fractography?
Yes. So one thing we did find was that the principal investigators in the study were a combination of anthropologists who had no previous experience doing fractography and fractographers who had no previous experience looking at bone. And what we found was that the people who had experience with fractography, regardless of what the material was, metal, plastic, whatever, those people just had a better eye for finding the features and finding more of them, which kind of makes sense. So even as anthropologists experienced in looking at bone, the anthropologists on this paper were not as skilled at finding as many features all the time as the fractographers were. So this does take some practice. But there is, a lot of self-guided practice that can be done, looking at broken bones, playing around with the lighting, playing around with, if you drop your coffee mug, you know, look at the fracture surface features and see what you can see. There's a lot of, I think, self-training that can be done. We would like to maybe one day put on a workshop, but a number of us are actually currently working on drafting what we hope will eventually be a guide, a practice guide for doing forensic fractography of bone. This is going to be sometime down the road. But in the meantime, I really would just encourage people to just get in there and do it. Just see what you can see. And also to read the literature on especially glass and ceramics. And there's a great guide already published by NIST on fractography of glasses and ceramics. And it provides a lot of great background information. And bone behaves very similar to those materials. Bone tends to fracture very much like a ceramic and display those fracture surface features very similar to ceramics. So I think for now, it'd be nice if people become familiar enough with it to start maybe incorporating it a little bit into education programs and maybe other training programs. I'm hoping more people might be presenting on research they're doing at upcoming scientific meetings. But really, I think a lot of just kind of reading some of the background and self-study and just looking at fractured bones is going to be a great course of action.
Yes. And I think at this point, too, this would be a good place to underscore the importance of case studies, too, that could incorporate this framework in their understanding or presentation of a case. I think in our field, showing is way more effective than telling.
I absolutely agree. And one of the things that I've always admired about a lot of Hugh Berryman's publications on trauma is that he's always emphasized that even if we don't totally understand what's happening yet, bone is following the laws of physics. It is breaking according to physical laws. And just because we don't know exactly what's happening yet doesn't make that not true. Bone isn't doing anything weird or unusual. It is following the laws of fracture mechanics like any other brittle material. I've always liked that about his work. And I think, you know, with that sort of mentality, then we're open to sort of looking more at these engineering type approaches instead of what's the shape of the bone that failed? What's the shape of the fragment? What's the shape of the crack? What is this actually telling us about what happened? It is telling us something. These patterns are not random.
As people begin to incorporate and utilize this method, do you have any aspects of the research that you feel might get missed along the way?
I don't really know the answer to that, because like I said, this paper was, I think, pretty low hanging fruit. I think we took what probably was the easiest bone in the body, looking at the biggest, most obvious features. So I think in terms of research, this is a really wide open field right now. I think looking at different loading conditions, different bones, different mechanisms of trauma, different speed of the projectile or the impactor, I really think there's just a million different ways that we can take this. But keeping in mind, of course, that you shouldn't really expect to find anything different than what they've been finding in research in these other materials over the years. And I agree with Mike that I think case studies will be great examples of that, of just showing and saying, hey, look, this bone broke exactly like you would expect it to based on principles of engineering. One of the issues with bone, of course, is that bone is not a manufactured material. So doing the math, basically, for bone is much more complicated than for some manufactured beam or some manufactured part, which is why we'll probably never be able to say things like, it took X amount of force to create this or, you know, to make this fracture. I think that is going to be a challenge. Now, that said, there are quantified techniques in fractography. There are relationships between lengths of cracks and shapes of cracks and amount of force applied. So maybe there is something to be gained there for bone, but I think the math is just always going to be trickier because bone adapts over time. It changes throughout an individual's life. It varies from individual to individual. So, you know, we're just not talking about some manufactured part with known dimensions or quantity or qualities.
Right. That's something that I would be interested in with this method is seeing how it might differ or vary looking at pediatric bone and how over time the difference in the bone composition and structure might change and how we might be able to apply fractography.
I mean, I would think we would because, I mean, fractography, it's largely used in the analysis of brittle materials, but it's also used for ductile metals. And so we know how those things fail too. Engineers have done all the math. And again, bone is so variable individually, you know, and throughout an individual's lifetime that that's going to make that complicated. But if we know these material properties, then, you know, in essence, we can basically predict what's going to happen given a certain type of force.
If you could go back and set up your perfect experiment to explore this topic in the future without any bars to what you could do, how would you have done it differently or do it differently in the future?
I think the high speed photography or videography is a really excellent approach. And as I mentioned, somebody's already kind of doing that, because literally you watch the fracture occur and then you can go back and look at those patterns later. And I think that's a great avenue. I don't know that I would have been able to do much different with this study, simply because it was just sort of exploratory in nature. We didn't know what we didn't know. We didn't even really have much of a hypothesis, just trying to see what we might see on bone compared to how these features appear in other materials.
Having looked at the different features within fractography, are there any that are more difficult than others to identify, especially coming from someone without that fractographic experience? Are there some that are more or less intuitive for an anthropologist?
For anthropologists, yes. So I think that arrest ridges are pretty easy to identify. Cantilever curl is going to be pretty easy to identify, I think, for most practitioners. If there is a mirror present, that's also usually fairly obvious. But one of the things about fractography is that these fracture features are present at all levels of magnification. So there have been many studies prior to mine looking at fractography of bone, just not from a forensic perspective. So a lot of these studies were trying to study bone's material properties by looking at very microscopic, usually using SEM levels. And there's detail at that level as well, but it's just looking at something a little bit different. So regardless of what level of detail you examine the bone, you're going to see fractographic features at some level. And that's kind of the beauty of fractography, that these features are there at many, many levels of magnification. But I do think what features that we did see most often were arrest ridges and cantilever curl and mirror. Some of the more subtle features, like hackle and some wake features, were either more difficult to identify or simply present less frequently. I'm not really sure at this point. But those features are more affected by the bone's microstructure. And given that bone has that much larger microstructure than, say, glass, you're just not going to see some of those fine, fine details like you're going to see in glass. So a lot of the principles of fractography have been developed from the study of glass. It's ideal because it has a very, very small microstructure. It's not affected by directional cracking behavior. So pretty much any fractographic feature out there you can see in glass. And then as microstructure becomes larger and larger, you sort of lose that fine detail. Bone, again, pretty large microstructure. It's also very hierarchical and a composite. So it has a lot of features of its composition that make it a little challenging for fractography, but the features are still there and still really informative. And this study focused on looking at the fracture surface, those changes across the fracture surface depending on location. But fractography involves not just looking at that fracture surface. That's what we did in that study, because that's, I think, the aspect of it that is a little new to most forensic anthropologists who really just want to glue the bone back together and look at the patterns of all the cracks. So that's why we kind of focused on that. But fractography involves all aspects of looking at cracks and fractures, not just the surface. I think it's really interesting that I learned through the course of the study that Steve Sims would teach this sort of thing in his program, but you don't really see that other places. So Steve was essentially doing fractography without knowing that he was doing fractography. And it'd be great if he had known before that all that terminology and everything was out there, because I think he would have been a great person to sort of merge these two fields. And it's unfortunate that he didn't discover it sooner. But I think it's great that people have started even looking at this and understanding that there's a relationship.
Certainly. That I encountered that, you know, talking to people about, oh, how do you know where the tension and compression is? And I would explain, oh, well, there's, you know, using whatever terminology I could, a smooth surface, a, you know, jagged surface, and that people didn't really know that. And they would say, oh, well, where is your citation for that? Steve Sims, personal communication. So it's great to have that, to provide this framework, as Mike said, and go for that low hanging fruit. I think a lot of us coming from training with Steve, you know, could have thought a little bit about, oh, where did this information come from? And why do we know this? And I love that this article presents a method and the science behind why we're seeing what we're actually seeing.
Yeah. And I think generally as anthropologists, we're getting a little better about not being so anthropology focused that people are actually reaching out now to, you know, biomechanics departments and engineering departments and working together and collaborating on research, which is great because like Mike said, these people have already done this science. They've already done the math and we don't need to reinvent the wheel. People have already studied these things and, you know, by working together. So I loved the collaboration on this study because we had people who deal with bone all the time, but never fractography, and people do with fractography all the time and never bone. And actually it was really interesting to me that the fractographers were better at bone fractography than anthropologists were. But I really think this is the future, that information is out there and we just need to incorporate it into what we're already doing. And it's not throw out everything else that we've been doing in terms of trauma analysis. Those other things are still important, but this is another way of looking at it that can be incorporated into a trauma analysis.
Certainly. That's the collaboration and ability to work interprofessionally is one of the things that I love most about anthropology and about forensic anthropology in particular, reaching out to, in your case, you know, engineers and forensic fractographers, but also reaching out to clinicians and odontologists, all sorts of different fields that are doing similar things and might have something to contribute to the same types of questions that we as anthropologists have. Do you think that you could condense the article, this might be a little difficult, into 3 major takeaways?
Okay, I'll try. So one would be just the introduction of the science of fractography and what this is. So fractography being, you know, using cracks and fractures to understand how something failed. So using that sort of approach versus just categorizing or, you know, typing a fracture shape. There are, in this article, we focused on fracture surface features. So what I would emphasize is that these surface features can tell us something about this crack, how this crack happened. So these changes that occur across a fracture surface feature tell us where the bone was in compression, where it was in tension. And from that, we can tell which direction the crack traveled and how the crack propagated through the bone. I would also emphasize that this is accessible. It is a lot of engineering behind it, but I do think that this is accessible for practitioners. So it's essentially just looking at the fracture surface using some basic tools like low power microscopy. I'm talking like 1-4x microscopy, indirect lighting. So something like a gooseneck light or probably even your cell phone light to provide a little indirect lighting to the bone surface and looking for these features and their orientation with respect to one another. These features then tell you which way the crack went. And for people who have never done it before, and as soon as I show even non-anthropologists, completely inexperienced practitioners, if you explain these changes and how they occur over the surface of the bone and provide just a few simple examples, pretty much anybody I've introduced this to within 5 minutes, at least 4 more obvious examples, can immediately determine which way the crack traveled through the bone. I mean, the features in a lot of cases are fairly obvious, and even not all the features even need to be there. Cantilever curl, arrest ridges. If you've got a couple of them, you can tell which way the crack went. So yeah, takeaways. Fractography, we can use it to look at bone. It can tell us which way the crack went and tell us something about the trauma event. This is an accessible technique with a few simple tools, a little bit of practice, and a little bit of background information. I think pretty much any practitioner can do this.
I love that. And I think the part of this article I think most fascinating is the fact that fractographers were better equipped at doing this. It makes a whole lot of sense. But what that demonstrates to me is that bone is not so unique a material that an understanding of these features won't allow you to understand it better than somebody that has a perceived understanding of what fractures and bone means from an anthropological perspective. So I think that just solidifies your point. We can use this. It can be incorporated if we train to look at for these things, as opposed to either no training in these things or passed down knowledge of just experience. So I think that should be a consideration for people listening or thinking about this, is that somebody from outside our discipline is better than you are at doing this.
Right.
But that shouldn't be a bad thing. That should tell you this is a learnable skill and that these people can employ it on these ways. So we should be able to as well.
Absolutely.
One thing that I thought about that might be, I don't know if challenging is the correct word, but one thing that might be different for an anthropologist to think about is the difference between crack propagation and looking at the direction that the crack is moving as opposed to the loading direction. How do you think that may play out with people trying to use this method and interpret it and use it, incorporate it into their forensic casework?
Well, I think it is important to have, this is why it's, you don't need to be an engineer, but why it's a little important to have some knowledge of fracture mechanics and bone biomechanics. So yes, you were talking about something that we pointed out in this article, which is that looking at these bone surface features tell us which way the crack traveled. And it's very reliable. The anthropologists, the fractographers, everybody could basically tell in 100% of the cases which way the crack traveled by looking at these features. But depending on the loading regime, the way the crack traveled doesn't necessarily correspond to or is not the same as the direction of applied force. So as many anthropologists, I think, are aware, you know, you impact a bone, it often breaks on the opposite side in bending because bone fails in tension. So what you get in those cases is a crack that is propagating back toward the impact location. So while the fractography might tell you the crack is running anterior to posterior, if it was a bending force, that means the force came posterior to anterior. And that could be a little confusing, but again, that's where some, you know, basic knowledge of how bone fails and different loading regimes on bone will come in handy. But I think, I hope that most people won't find that part very confusing, since I think it's fairly well understood and frequently taught that, you know, bones often fail in bending and they break on the opposite side of the impact.
I think that's a wonderful point, though, is that you're looking at crack propagation and you have an understanding of what that means in a larger context for direction of applied force in a bending situation. But I do think that's that particular point. I'm thinking of a traditional butterfly fracture of somebody on like a tib fib where they got hit by a car or something like that. The crack propagation is going to tell you something that is 100% different from the direction of force, but that just reinforces your argument because you have an understanding of the way bone fails. And I do think that point wouldn't get lost on people, that they would think that crack propagation had a one-to-one correlate to direction of force. And I think it is important to couch that with a greater understanding of the way bone fails the way you did. So thank you for pointing that out.
I have a question for you that is outside of the article a little bit, but you have had an illustrious career and produce lots of amazing research. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for aspiring forensic anthropologists, particularly women that are looking to further themselves in the field.
Well, I would point out that, as I think this paper kind of does, that there is so much left to do. So I also teach, so I'm frequently working with students who are confronted with needing to come up with a research topic for their master's thesis. And often coming up with the research question is the hardest part of the thesis. If you have an understanding of the scientific method and, you know, how to test a hypothesis, then once you have a research question, all that kind of just falls into place. But coming up with an idea is usually the hardest part for most people. So I would emphasize there's always going to be something that we don't know. And I would, maybe given the success that I had with this paper and how, you know, excited I still am about this type of work, that I would really encourage people, look toward other disciplines. If there's something we don't know about bone, is there some other field, some other discipline, somebody else who might have kind of worked this out? And even if it's not on bone, you know, like working with engineers or, you know, other disciplines that might be looking at similar problems for different types of structures, to work on those sorts of collaborations. Because I think those are super beneficial to our science. And there's probably, you know, the fractographers that I worked with loved working with bone. It was totally new and interesting to them. So I think that both disciplines will probably, you know, benefit from reaching out and trying to collaborate. So there is just a lot out there still. So I don't want students to feel frustrated, like, they come up with an idea. So this happens to me a lot in my research advising, that students come up with an idea and something sort of like that has already been done. So what are you doing that's new, that's interesting? I feel like for the most part, you know, with a little bit of literature review, you'll find some little tweak, some little aspect that somebody else hasn't looked at yet, some new technology that you're aware of that the previous person wasn't, some little new spin of your own that you can put on this. So there's always something, I think. So I just reach out, read some literature, reach out to colleagues in other disciplines, and there's always going to be something there.
Definitely. I think that's a really great point, particularly in designing research and coming up with projects like master's theses and eventually dissertations. I think sometimes the problem is almost having too much to ask and trying to narrow that down. But a lot of times articles like yours provide some guidance as well. They say, these are other areas, these are other avenues that we haven't looked at yet. And you can kind of go from there. They provide a platform to continue doing research.
Right. I think another thing that stumps students sometimes is trying to cure cancer in a thesis. You know, students always just think of these really grand problems and things that would be really, really great. And I'm like, if you had 20 years to write a dissertation on this, sure. But you mentioned a lot of my research, and I have published a lot in recent years, but a lot of them are just honestly pretty small project and sometimes proof of concept projects or just little technical notes, just things that kind of occur to me. And I just say, why don't we just test that thing and then publish it? A research project doesn't have to be, you know, so grandiose. It doesn't have to solve all the problems of anthropology. Just one little piece, just have one little question. Why do we do this? Or would this work? Or why wouldn't that work? And just test some small little thing. It's still research. It doesn't have to be enormous to be research and to be interesting and to be helpful to other people in the field.
That's such good advice. I wish you were around when I started my dissertation and I thought, I'm going to figure out how to determine the age of healing fractures in children. And that's what I'm going to do. And then that is not what I ended up doing at all. It ended up being something much more small, a much smaller question, not curing cancer, something smaller.
Of course, but those little projects are things other people can build on. You know, if you want to, you know, take your project and set that as a lifetime goal for yourself, you know, that's one thing. But if you're looking to publish something as a thesis, or, you know, even just a lot of my research projects are really just like ideas that I had or things that I came across in my casework that I wondered about or just wanted to look at in a little bit more detail. It's not just because it's small or the focus is small doesn't make it not research or not interesting or not useful.
Yes, definitely. And I feel like the benefit of the forensic anthropology journal is it's a great avenue to put out that research and bring it to a more focused forensic anthropology community. And I think that's really great.
I agree. And actually, I really love that the journal encourages case reports and, you know, technical notes and things. I would love to see some case reports on fractography, how somebody used fractography to look at how some fracture occurred in a forensic context. Because forensic fractures are going to be, honestly, quite a bit different than the controlled four-point bending specimens that I looked at. They're going to be messier. They're going to be different. But I agree. I really think it's such a great venue for anthro-specific, the encouragement of publishing case studies that are informative and educational to the readership.
I absolutely love that point. Could I flesh out or kind of frame what you've just said in this advice? Because I think this is super important to kind of the spirit and intent of the podcast. Is you mentioned you are doing all these like kind of one-off projects because you wanted to figure out this thing either from a need or just a desire to find out. I think this speaks to a sense of curiosity on your part, and that what you have learned is a tool set to be curious about the world and how to investigate those things in a way that gives you an answer. So, in being able to frame questions, right, when we're trying to lead students into how to think about questions, what we're not teaching them is this is your dissertation topic. We're teaching them how to frame questions you can answer, how to ask questions you can answer, how to test questions you can answer. And it's not what you answer that's important. It's that framework. It's giving you a tool set that allows you to be curious about the world in these different ways. And that can allow you to be highly productive, but it also informs the rest of us a lot. And a lot of students too, they undervalue what it means to find negative results or nothing. And at that point, I try to ask them, do you know what the definition of information is? Usually no one has an idea. And I was like, it's the reduction in uncertainty, right? You've reduced our uncertainty. It didn't work out, but now we know it didn't work out. That's a good thing. We can move on. We don't have to stay here anymore. But I think curiosity about the world mixed with looking outside of our own experience, right? Looking into diverse research fields, those two things together produce these rich research projects or allow you to ask these different ideas that no one else thinks to ask. And this might seem like a low-hanging fruit, but I think that's deprecating. If it's so low-hanging, then why has no one done it, right? It's not low-hanging. It takes a perspective shift. It takes thinking outside of your own experience and realizing that maybe our field doesn't have all the answers. That's okay. We can be better. We should be better. But I think calling it just low-hanging fruit is not really appropriate here. So I guess I just wanted to point out, I don't think this is low-hanging fruit. I love this. I think this is a beautiful framework and shows so many different aspects that I think our field desperately needs. And it's stoking this idea of kind of inclusion, diversity, creativity, and curiosity, not motivated by any small thing like I need to get X amount of publications to get tenure or whatever, but just so we can be better and honestly ask and answer questions about the world.
So let me just explain. I don't mean that I thought it was easy. I mean that in terms of fractography, we picked basically the easiest thing to look at, where our probability of success was going to be pretty high. And I think that under different conditions, people might find that they're like, I don't see all the features that Angie saw in this paper, but the fracture conditions are very different. We did find things like you see more features the more cortical area there is, because these features show up better on cortical bone than they do on trabecular bone. We picked the easiest bone and the easiest conditions where we were likely to see these features. That's what I meant by low-hanging fruit. Then in the future, people may not be as likely to find as many features to be quite as obvious. But that's okay, because we need to understand how we're going to see these things. And starting here is as good a place to start as any for a path forward.
Yeah. And you need to use like kind of the biggest, best example you can to push these sort of new ideas. You can't,
absolutely.
There's no way you're going to use like the fourth rib and look at
exactly
buckle yep. fractures and make this argument in as a right. cogent way.
You need a platform, yeah. A big platform to start from.
Exactly. Yes. I want to circle back to Mike's comment about negative results, because I run into the same thing where students are terrified if they have negative results, that they are going to basically fail their thesis, that there's something wrong with their project. And I really would love to see more negative results published. How many times have people repeated the same project because they didn't know somebody else did it, because they got negative results and didn't publish it? You know, how much time are we wasting getting negative results over and over again because we didn't know somebody else already tried that? So I think that's a really great point too.
It makes me physically sick to think about all of the data that's been collected on the same samples, looking at the same or slightly different things, that's just lost to history because somebody didn't think their thesis was good enough to publish, because maybe somebody was like, yeah, well, that didn't work out, huh? So let's just move on.
Looping back to Diana's earlier question about, you know, students maybe interested in research, is that it also doesn't necessarily have to be publishable. I mean, it's great if it is, but for something, especially like the master's level, it's really more important for students to understand the research process than it is for them to end up with something that's groundbreaking or publishable. So, you know, if I have a student who just gets through the process of coming up with a question and forming a hypothesis and actually collecting data that supports or refutes that hypothesis, I mean, that's really part of the experience. And even if it ends up being something that maybe was already basically done and they got just slightly different results, or it's not really, they're not strong writers, so it's probably not going to be publishable. Either way, it's really more about just understanding the scientific process and strive less for something that's groundbreaking or even that necessarily can be published, and just more, it's more important just to understand how the scientific process works.
I think that's such a great point for up and coming students and moving forward in their careers. And maybe it doesn't necessarily lead to a publication, but they know how to set up that research and how to ask those questions. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you feel like you'd like to address about the paper or anything else of your choosing?
Well, I think another thing that this paper potentially does is bring us more in line with engineering terminology and engineering approaches so that, say, for example, you are ever testifying about this and they bring an engineer in on the other side. You know, at least we're talking about the same thing and we're using the principles and the terminology that are already very well established instead of just making up our own stuff.
Right. So you're up against an engineer. They understand this stuff intrinsically. We don't. Say you have a butterfly fracture, and I'm particularly going to the part in your paper where you talk about how forensic anthropology, we often oversimplify what that actually means. In a practical sense, what do you think an anthropologist can say about a butterfly fracture? Like if you're up against an engineer, how would you handle that kind of exchange, I guess?
Or maybe how would the fractographic examination assist in a more accurate interpretation of the butterfly fracture?
I think it would be more about just having the awareness and the understanding of the engineering of how that fracture occurred, rather than just saying, well, it looks like a V and the textbooks tell me that means the fracture started here under tension. Well, if you look at that fracture surface, we can tell that that's where the bone was in tension. And the cantilever curl tells us that the loading regime was at least in part bending. So I think just having that knowledge, and sure, anybody can look at that shape and probably tell you for the most part which, you know, how that happened, but to have a more thorough understanding of why that happened, that you just don't hit a bone with the bumper of a car and make a triangle. I mean, there are actually fracture mechanics behind how that occurred. And I think the ability to just kind of understand that, even if you don't ever have to explain it on the stand, having a better understanding of that. Then I think if you did have to explain it on the stand, you have a much better idea of that conceptually, engineering wise, how that happened, not just something hit the bone and it broke in a triangle.
And I think that separates the way that anthropologists look at skeletal trauma versus a clinician or a pathologist or a radiologist for whom terms like butterfly fracture is important from a clinical perspective and how they're going to approach treatment of that fracture, but that we're really looking at, did that fracture happen, and that clinically maybe isn't as relevant. So those terms that we're using are one step, but not really getting at the basis of how the fracture actually occurred.
I agree, but we're anthropologists, so we like to describe things and put things into categories. And I realize that that's how we like to do this, but this stuff all occurs along a continuum, right? So it's sort of like the blunt force, the projectile, and the sharp force. They're not three different things. They're places along a continuum of how fast something is moving and how big the surface area is. So I think it's that sort of mentality of understanding, okay, in some contexts, it's useful to have descriptors or things like, you know, to be able to use a word like butterfly fracture, but to understand why does it fracture like a butterfly? Why are there cantilever curls on the ends of those butterfly wings? Why is it flat where the tip of the butterfly started, where it's in tension? Understanding why those things look that way and not just that a bumper makes a butterfly fracture. I think that's just really important.
And better address the questions that were asked by law enforcement, the questions that we have in forensic cases. How did this happen? What's the loading direction? How did this bone fail? This helps us to better address those questions than just to say, oh, it's a butterfly fracture.
Yeah, of course. And then, I mean, for many years, butterfly fractures were interpreted exactly backwards, right? That was in all the forensic pathology textbook, that you assume that the fracture started where the impact was. And that was just sort of the general knowledge. And now we're learning that that's not true on tubular bones when they're bent, that fractures don't start at the impact on a cranium. They can start at remote areas and radiate back toward the impact site. But again, bone isn't unusual. These patterns aren't random. Bone is following the laws of physics.
Thank you, Dr. Christensen. What a great opportunity to learn more and get into the details, not only just about the article, but also about doing research and some helpful tips for students to do research as well. I know that I feel even more invigorated to continue doing work in my area of fracture healing, and hopefully in the future coming out with a type of technical note similar to this particular article. And I'm also really excited to apply this forensic fractography to real forensic casework.
Me too. I'm excited to see what might come from this, because this is just a baseline study that shows us the way that we might be able to think about trauma in the future. And I think this is going to lead us all to much richer interpretations from trauma. So like Steve would always say, we can stop inferring so much from so little and infer what we can, given the tools at our disposal. Thank you so much to Dr. Messer for joining us. And I hope that you will come back whenever you feel like you would want to do whatever you'd like to do. Is there any place that people that are interested in following you might be able to reach out or to see what you're up to?
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me. I had such a great time. If people want to check me out, you can look up dianamesser.com and reach me at that address.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.